We're going to call the Local Government and Metropolitan Affairs Committee to order. Today is Monday, February 18th, and we do not yet have a quorum. We're going to get started and present bills. A few of these bills we have previously heard, and so we're going to vote the bills out together one at a time after we get a quorum. The transportation bill is currently being heard in taxes, for which I am a member as well, and so is the majority of this committee. So we're going to let the bills be presented, then we'll bring them back up to vote on them later, unless there's an objection of a member of the committee. All right. With that, Mr. Anzelk, I see you're here in the audience. So we're going to start with your three bills. Do you just want to go ahead and start at the top?
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I'm not sure what the top is, but
611.
611. 611 is a bill dealing with workplace communication. It went through the process last year. I'm not quite sure why it's back here this year, but it passed through a number of committees. All of the committees to which it was referred last year. It allows employers and employees to create rules, reasonable rules, through which we will govern communications in the workplace between groups of employees. It allows employees to have control over communication with their bargaining agent, and that's it.
All right. Members, I just want to clear up that it's pursuant to House Rule 4.20 that once a bill received its full hearing and then ended up on the floor, that it is returned back to the last committee that it passed out. We have to send it back
okay.
to the floor. So this bill did currently pass this, or did pass this committee last session. So are there questions of members? Representative Biscuit.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, a couple of questions of the author. First question is on page 1, line 25, and continuing over to page 2. I believe the sentence goes to 2.3. Madam Chair, could the author explain how the definition of reasonable rules is going to be worked? I found in my 20-some years of adulthood that reasonable lies in the eye of the beholder. So where would the parameters for reasonable rules be set in the author's mind?
Mr. Representative Anzelk.
Thank you. Representative Biskins, reasonable rules are to be determined at the bargaining table between the two parties. And certainly what's reasonable must be agreed upon by both of the parties at the table, or they must not be reasonable. So it's hoped that in the negotiations process between employer and employee that we can arrive at reasonableness.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, again to the author, then would it not, if that is the intent of the author, would it not then be appropriate on line 3 of page 2 to, after the word permitted, insert as determined through negotiation efforts? Otherwise, you're leaving it wide open. Now, I understand your intent, and we have it on public record. However, anyone reading the legislation later on would not know that that is your intent, and so there'd be a lot of digging that would have to go on. If the intent is that the rules governing reasonableness when it comes to quality of communications, political or inappropriate content of communications, etc., at all, if that determination is to be made at the bargaining table through the collective bargaining process, would it not be then wise to put that verbiage within the legislation?
Representative Enzo.
Madam Chair, once again, I think the language is reasonable, and I think it allows both parties acting in good faith to iron out differences and to arrive at what is a reasonable rule governing conduct by workers.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, I think the author errs if he believes that the word reasonableness will be one that will be decided amicably. I think that is typically where the biggest contention comes in. What's reasonable when it comes to salary? What's reasonable when it comes to benefits? What's reasonable when it comes to rules governing the workplace? That's why we have a thing called bargaining, and that's why bargaining is followed then by arbitration and ultimately mediation. Madam Chair, I do have another question of the author, if I may.
Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. To the author, today on the House floor, Representative Emmer brought up an issue dealing with organizing and employer discretion. I'll use that word carefully. As it pertains to the AG's office. Madam Chair, author, is there any, would there be any ramification to the AG's office if this piece of legislation were to pass into law?
Representative Anzal, tread cautiously. I think that as any time someone is asking for an investigation to be done, that it is important that we just be mindful of that in our comments.
Yeah, Madam Chair and Representative Biskin, my only comment was I can't predict the future regarding that, and the matter on the House floor today I don't think has any bearing on this very simple piece of good labor legislation, which simply allows workers to be able to communicate with each other in the workplace, whether it be electronically or in the lunchroom. You know, some of us grew up in northeastern Minnesota on the Iron Range, and you literally couldn't go to the barber shop to get your hair cut because the barber would turn you into the company for anything that you said, which the barber might construe to be anti-company. I don't think we need to go back. I don't think we need to treat workers as second-class citizens. All we're doing is allowing workers to talk to each other. Post notices. Let workers know of social events, business events, organizing events, community events. I just think workers need not be treated as second-class citizens.
All right.
Thank you.
Are you finished?
One more point, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, and I do appreciate your caution to the author to tread carefully. That is a very wise admonition. And I would second that caution as this piece of legislation moves forward to the author of the bill, particularly as it pertains to page 1, lines 20, through line 22. Read those lines carefully, put them in context of what's currently happening in the AG's office, then, as the chair of the committee has recommended, tread very carefully as you move forward.
Representative Beard.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Anzell, a few moments ago you talked about the definition of reasonable, and then I think you indicated it would be bargained out between a unit and a company. Am I to give an understanding that this bill applies only to union shops where they have compulsory union attendance, and it doesn't apply to shops where perhaps there's a merit shop and the employees do not belong to a trade union or any union for that matter?
Representative Anthony.
Madam Chair and Representative Baird, it would apply in both situations. It's just that in a non-union situation, the workers would have to probably get on their knees and ask for a meeting. to discuss rules of conduct as it relates to communication. In a collective bargaining situation, it's a more formal, more guaranteed process that rules would be developed. It will be easier to develop rules in a collective bargaining situation than it will be in a merit shop. I'll give you that.
Madam Chair, members, I remember of this discussion now last year going forward in the fascinating discussion about an employer of any stripe who invests in mostly email technology to make his or her business more competitive, to keep people in the loop so they can do their jobs, and having that privately bought and paid for infrastructure used from the outside by email blasts to all employees for organizing purposes. And I think one of the questions that was asked was, if that's going to be the case, can then employers use that email also to resist the efforts of a union that is trying to come onto the property? How do you see that working, Representative Anzo?
Representative Anzo.
Madam Chair and Representative Beard, I actually have to thank you for raising that issue, because at the present time, under the National Labor Relations Board and its activities of the last 7 or 8 years, it's very difficult for workers to organize, especially when they can't communicate, especially knowing that the employer can communicate. That is exactly one of the purposes of this legislation, to put the workers on an even footing as with the employer.
All right, Representative Beard.
Well, I'm not a labor attorney, Madam Chair, but I have a hunch that any employer that uses email to encourage his employees not to organize would probably find himself in court real fast for a labor board violation. I would argue about the definition of what's fair and which way the wind is blowing. But nonetheless, I do recall this, and I think it's passed out of here without my vote, and I will not be supporting it again. Furthermore, I'll notice that apparently there's a national, an NLRA ruling. In fact, no, it's a Supreme Court ruling that in California something like this was tried, and I think the court held that it actually was preempted by federal law, and we may be treading down that road and exercising futility, but that's just one man's observation. But.
All right, thank you. Members, given the fact that this was previously heard, my intention is to take public testimony only if it has not been said before. So I don't want any of the repeat of last year. However, if there is someone in the audience who wishes to add something new to the discussion, please come to the table, state your name for the record. All right, seeing none, members, I'm going to lay this one over until we have a quorum. Representative Anzalk, if you would go on to House File 2636.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. House File 2636, and joining me at the witness table is Kent Sullum. Did I pronounce that correctly? Sullum, from the Association of Minnesota Townships. This is a bill that comes to us from a township government, specifically in a number of townships in extreme northern Minnesota. I believe there is an amendment in your packet.
There is, Representative Anzalk. However, we can't take it up, but you can describe it for us, and then we'll take it up when we get a quorum.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm going to allow the township attorney to describe the amendment, and then I will describe the original bill.
All right. Mr. Sullum, go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Kent Sullum on behalf of the Minnesota Association of Townships. What the amendment does, this entire bill deals with provisions in 365.10, which is a laundry list of 18 subdivisions of what town residents may authorize their town board to do on their behalf at the annual town meeting. Subdivision 8 of that deals with expending of funds on a township park, but there's conflicting language in the statute that says the electors may decide by ballot the amount of money to be raised for these purposes, and then it goes on current law to read the electors may vote to tax a tax to pay for what they allow under the subdivision. The reason we are proposing to strike the word the sentence dealing with by ballot is that the annual meeting, they are voting as residents, not by ballot, it's a formal election. If we leave that line in, it is argued to trigger the need to put it at the election, not the annual meeting. And all the other subdivisions of that statute has had this language struck, so it's clear that you're voting at the meeting, not at the election, which is done on the same day in most townships, but it is an entirely separate process. So that's what the amendment does. It adds an additional section to the bill, deleting confusing and duplicative language.
All right. Representative Anzalk, we technically have a quorum now. So first I will move that House File 2788, House File 2636, the bill that we are on, be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. And then I will move your amendment, the A08-1104 amendment. Questions from members regarding this amendment? All right, seeing none.
Madam?
Yes, okay. Representative Biskin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Madam Chair, to Mr. Sulem, Madam Chair, the question is, does the striking of the language which talks about a ballot to set the amount differ from the second sentence, which is a vote to raise that amount via tax? I think there is a substantive change and not just a an elimination of duplicative language. The first sentence says that they have to spend an amount. Now, if the electorate decides to spend $5,000 and then they vote not to tax to pay for it, the town board is still under the obligation to expend the $5,000 out of it, and then they have to reprioritize. However, if we strike that first language, then it would seem to me that the only way the town board could raise the funds in a vote to beautify and improve the parks, et cetera, would be to do so by raising their taxes. And I think that's a little dangerous, as we know people are very hesitant to raise their own taxes, even when they think that the issue is important, and I'll throw school referenda out there. So is there not a concern here that the board may not be able to spend more on beautifying parks?
Mr. Sulem.
Madam Chair, Representative Biskin, I think when you read the totality of the subdivision, that the electors have to authorize any of these activities, and then they may vote to tax. So they can say, look, we don't need a tax. If there's existing funds, spend the existing funds. If you wish to increase the levy specifically for those purposes, then they may create that dedicated levy for that purpose. But it's the rest of the subdivision that's already putting it in the hands of the electors. And remember, at the township level, no levy is passed without the voters approving it. So we are already self-limiting. It has to be approved by the voters at the annual meeting. So by striking that sentence, what we're saying is, instead of doing it by ballot at the election, when you use the term by ballot, you're triggering state election law and saying it goes as a ballot question. But the general authority is still covered by the rest of the subdivision. Then if they also wish to dedicate a specific levy to it, that would be done by a specific action.
All right, further questions? Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? I didn't adopt the amendment, I'm sorry, members. All those in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. To the bill, Representative Enzo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment makes the bill a better one. Quite frankly, the thrust of the bill makes very, very clear and appropriate some practices that some townships have engaged in for many, many, many years. And that is, once a year, townships throughout the state would hold an annual meeting and dinner or supper to recognize special achievements of residents, to recognize Meals on Wheels volunteers, to recognize retiring town officers, and to have a community event thanking community members for what they gave to the community. This language will make it very, very clear that township funds can be used to hold such a event. And that's basically the bill.
Mr. Solem.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, and the reason that the original bill was necessary is that several years ago, the Attorney General came down with an opinion saying, while these types of activities meet the public purpose doctrine of the state, there was not clear enough authority to say that there was statutory authority to do it. So when this situation arose in Representative Anzell's district, we had to tell the township, well, we understand you've done it. We understand there's a public benefit to doing it. We understand that people want it. But the Attorney General says there's no authority. The state auditor in the past has also cited that AG's opinion. And so, again, we're putting this in the provisional law where the voters at the annual meeting have to decide that this is something they want. It's not something that will be forced on them. It isn't spending money at the town board's will. This is something the voters would reauthorize, saying, we recognize this and like this in our community. So the board, you now have the authority. The Attorney General says it's lacking.
Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none, members, I would renew my motion that House File 2636 be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
Aye.
Motion prevails. All right, members, we're going to go back to House File 611 now that we have a quorum. And I would renew my motion that be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. All right. Next, Representative Anzalk is House File 2788.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
And this needs to be referred to the Committee on Energy, Finance, and Policy. So I would move that House File 2788 be recommended to pass and re-referred to the Committee on Energy, Finance, and Policy. Representative Anzell.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Joining me is the Mayor of the Community of Nashwauk, Bill Hendricks. This legislation asks that the Nashwauk Municipal Public Utilities be increased from 3 members to 5 members, which was also done in 1999 for Grand Rapids and in 2002 for the communities of Delano and Shakopee. Members, Nashwauk is located along the iron ore formation on the western Mesabi and is soon to become the epicenter of the rebirth of the mining industry and hopefully the steel industry, the birth of the steel industry in Minnesota. The Nashwauk Municipal Public Utility will be in the forefront in providing various services and utilities to this steel plant, which will employ 700 workers year-round. We will have a construction project totaling over 2,000 workers. There will be spin-offs of another couple of thousand jobs. And the mayor and the city council of Nashwauk have by resolution asked that their PUC be increased from 3 citizens to 5 to better able to serve the community, bring more opinions, more input into the process of providing municipal public utilities. And with that, that's basically why we're here, and the mayor and I are willing to try to answer any of your questions.
All right. Mr. Hendricks, did you want to speak, or were you just here to answer questions?
If you want me to speak, I'll speak, but I'm here to answer questions, I guess, if somebody has a question.
All right. Questions from members? All right. Hearing none. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right, seeing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Anzell.
Thank you very much.
Representative Simon, is he here? Nope. Representative Peterson. I will move House File 3157 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Chair Hillstrom. And my testifier, County Commissioner from Big Stone, I think got held up in weather today. I haven't heard from him all day, so I'll just go with this. It's relatively short from the bill summary. It's already occurring in the county of Big Stone, one of Minnesota's smallest. This would just permit the county board of a resolution to assign to the county treasurer duties related to delinquent real property taxes, including forfeiture of real property and for non-payment of taxes, requires concurrence between the treasurer and the auditor, and it's effective after the county board would approve this. Sometimes when you say auditor and treasurer and such, people assume you're talking about merging them or making them appointed and not and taking them off the ballot and such like that. That's not the case with this. It's already occurring, started in a waiver, was granted, I believe, in 06, extended in 07, and according to the state auditor, Otto, that, I'll just read from it, the county has effectively created a more efficient system for its citizens and taxpayers by allowing blah, 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 information and services related to delinquent tax processes to be handled by one department. Basically saying they've given the renewal granted so the county may use this additional time between July 30, 2007 when I got the letter to quote obtain legislation during the 2008 session to transfer such duties permanently. So that's what we're asking for is local approval from the county board to have this to be a permanent type of way of doing business in Big Stone County.
Question for members. Representative Holder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Peterson, who gave the temporary authority?
Representative Peterson.
In my file, I believe that would have probably have had to have been, well, who was auditor before Otto? Excuse me?
Pat.
Yeah, the one before Otto.
From the state auditor's office?
Yes.
And was it under the provision of the cost saving? And what authority did...
Well, I don't... Excuse me.
Please go to the chair for the tape just because they can't hear who's talking.
I'm sorry, Madam Chair. I know that when we got rid of the Board of Innovation and Cooperation, we put in legislation that allowed certain... Ms. Dyson's shaking her head, so she might be able to put more structure to this, but we allowed some entities to give, like, temporary... classifications to change of the way of doing business, similar to what the Board of Innovation was able to do prior to its demise. So I'm wondering if that was the authority that was used in this case, if somebody knows.
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair, Representative Holberg and members, yes, this was the State Auditor's Office in June of 2006 granted the waiver request by the county to allow these duties to be shifted over temporarily, and it was under the provision that you're referring to that allows for changes or waivers from statutory requirements related to procedural duties, not substantive law duties, but procedural duties, and the county had passed its resolution saying that they thought it would be good to transfer these. The state auditor's office agreed and granted the temporary waiver, and the special law would make it a permanent authority.
And Representative Holberg,
if I might, do we know of any other counties that are thinking this is such a great idea? I mean, is there a reason why, because your county's so small, or, I mean, I'm not understanding why we're doing this, and if it's such a great idea, why we don't do it for everybody.
Ms. Dyson.
Madam Chair and Representative Holberg, I can't answer that directly in terms of waivers process, but what I can tell you is under the options in county government law, well over half of the counties in the state already have authority by means of having merged the auditor-treasurer's office and then being allowed to restructure how those duties are provided, or by having county the authority to, having made their auditor or treasurer's offices appointed, which then puts it under the county board, and then they can restructure how duties are performed as long as the duties are performed. So I haven't seen this specific legislative approach. This leaves all of the county officers elected in individual positions, but allows a shifting of duties. But other laws out there and have already made it possible for over half the counties to do it, but I don't know if they do it, so, but they could.
Okay, and Representative Holberg, just Representative Peterson, now that the county auditor doesn't have to do all of those duties, what are they doing with all the rest of the time? Representative Peterson.
Thank you. Hilton and Holberg, I don't know. They could have driven down here and testified for the bill. They did. I don't know.
I don't really like one county specific kind of exception type things that we've got. A process that is or isn't working. I mean, it seems like from what Ms. Dyson has said that other counties looking for more efficiency have actually abolished the position of auditor, taking it off the ballot, or done some real change, where this county seems to say, well, we're going to give half of your job to this person, but you're still going to stay on the books and on the ballot, even though we took away half your work. I'm not really understanding. Representative Peterson.
Chair Hilstrom and Representative Holberg. Yeah, I've done these types of county-type bills before. I don't necessarily have a clear answer for you. You know, it's like I'm representing county government. This is one of the requests. The state auditor Otto seems to think that it works. You can't just be getting waivers all the time and obtain legislation during the session is the auditor's recommendation.
All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? All right. Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 3157 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? No. Motion prevails. Thank you. Representative Braun. Representative Beard, would you like to move Representative Broad's bill?
Madam Chair, I'd be delighted to move House File 2599 and recommend it pass and be sent to
the General Register.
General Register, all right. Mm-hmm. Fast track. I'd be happy to make that motion.
All right. Representative Beard moves House File 2599 be recommended to pass and placed on the General Register. Representative Broad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just for the record, I do have with me also here Representative Ron Chemansky, who has a bill that does similar things, and so we thought we'd just collaborate on this hearing. So thanks so much for hearing the bill. What this bill essentially does is that it increases the statutory limit that a county may appropriate for the purposes of Memorial Day observances. The numbers have been in place since 1979, and this just increases the cap. Now, just to be clear, it doesn't force any counties to spend any dollars or spend anything. It just essentially lifts that cap, lifts the opportunity for that expenditure if they so desire.
Representative Chemansky.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I would just echo the comments of Representative Broad in talking with our local county commissioners. They had looked at it and they wondered where would the money come from, and I said, well, it's part of their budgeting process, and with the effective date of July 1, 2008, it would give them the opportunity to budget for it in the 09 for Memorial Day services and so forth. But it was recommended by many of the Legion and VFW posts in my district that asked for the simply raising the allowance so that their folks could more actively participate in their Memorial Day services.
All right. Are there questions from members? All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Beard renews his motion that House File 2599 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Simon. Representative Simon, I will move that House File 1762 be recommended to pass and be placed on the General Register, and it's my understanding we have an author as amendment. Would you like to take that first?
Yes, please.
All right. I will also move the author's amendment 8-1762-DE2 to get it in the order the author would like. Would you like to speak to the amendment, Representative Simon?
Yes, and I'll do that by way of a general kind of background. This is back, this bounced back from the General Register members that it was passed in a voice vote, I believe unanimously, towards the end of last session. I know committee deadlines were approaching and things were pretty chaotic, that's all I remember, but it did pass. And the idea, the basic idea here is that charter commissions in statutory cities ought to have some accountability. And if there's been a problem recently in some places where that hasn't always been the case, where charter commissions, once empowered, can go on and on and on and on. There's no sunset, there's no deadline. And more to the point, they can, as you know far better than I, because I'm new to this issue, they can basically put cities through elections multiple times, and there's really no end in sight. And so I've been speaking with folks from a couple different suburban communities here in the Twin Cities that have had this problem. And the initial idea was just to provide some sort of accountability, some sort of way that a charter commission could be dissolved other than by self-dissolution. And so the original bill, the one that I just amended by way of an author's amendment, actually the initial bill said a few things. It said, all right, we're going to have a 4 or 5 year sunset, because it seemed to me that if the Founding Fathers could write the greatest document, governing document in the history of the world in 4 months, certainly 4 or 5 years was long enough for most charter commissions to do likewise, or to write their own language. And then the second thing that the old bill did was to say, look, if a proposed charter goes before a city and it gets below 25% of the vote, then that charter commission is deemed dissolved, and they can automatically come back in a year and sort of re-up and go to the judge and try to reform. And there was sort of this tiered basis. Well, in the interim, and that's the version, by the way, that all of you passed out here unanimously on a voice vote last year. But in the interim, the League of Minnesota Cities has been working on this issue and has allowed me and many other advocates, stakeholders, and other interested parties to weigh in on this. And the League has come up with this language, which seems to be a sensible compromise. It does away with this sort of tiered approach, which we had before, which was, hey, if you get 25% or less, then you're out, you're done, and you have to come back in a year if you want to reconstitute. The League's approach, which I think representatives from the League can explain, is, I think, a sensible compromise that people agree to. And with that, maybe Ms. Higgins can speak to what exactly the language that we just in the author's amendment said.
Okay, Ms. Higgins, go ahead.
My name is Ann Higgins from the League of Minnesota Cities. Just to summarize, we have a policy development process with the League where we bring city officials together, and this is the result of their discussions and having heard from a number of city officials from statutory cities who have gone through the development of a charter. And in some cases, they have, in fact, become home rule charter cities. Others have not. And our resulting policy suggests and supports the concept of having a petition process for an election and using 5% of the registered voters in that city as of the last election to bring to the city a request. Actually, it would be a mandate for an election to be held subsequently according to state law, state election law, state municipal election law, for the city voters once again to decide if they want to continue with a charter commission, to continue to find a way to a home rule process, or to end that process at that point by deciding to dissolve the commission as a result of a vote. Rather than an action of the City Council or just as a result of a petition itself. We thought that as long as the Charter Commission recommendations have been subject to an election, that having it subject to an election to dissolve the Charter might be the most straightforward way to end that particular matter, one way or the other.
All right. Questions from members? Representative Shumper.
Madam Chair, Ms. Higgins, who appoints a charter commission? I assume it's probably the city council. Couldn't they discharge, or am I wrong?
Madam Chair, Representative Summer, no, the district court appoints the members of the charter commission.
And
Representative Stumper.
Couldn't the district court discharge them, or?
Mystic, Madam Chair, Representative Stumper, that is something that would be perhaps a possibility, except the law doesn't give this court that authority.
All right. Further questions for members? Representative Holder.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Simon, I like your old bill better. I don't think, for the fact that the cities have to go through a whole other election, you look at what happened in Eagan, was it 3 or 4% voted yes? I wish you'd look, even if you said under 5% voted for it, it's pretty clear twice now in Eagan that measure has been just trounced on the ballot. The expense of that has been incurred, and as long as the Charter Commission stays in effect, the city has to fund it. There's a certain, I don't remember what the amount of money is, the city has to cough up the money to the Charter, and so another year is going to go by while they try and get, a ballot measure or whatever. So while I understand the need to compromise, I just think that having to go through a whole other ballot process with even more expense to the taxpayers of the community that obviously doesn't want it is unfortunate.
Representative Simon.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just one other thing. I know you have other bills to consider, but I still remember your comment last year, Representative Holberg, where a person from the Charter Commission was sitting here, and that charter had received 20% of the vote. And you turned to that person and you said, what are you still doing? I still remember that. I vividly remember that. You said, what are you doing? You've been absolutely, resoundingly rejected, and you're not self-dissolving. You're not. And this, my understanding is they came back again, and this time they got 10%.
No, I think it was 91%.
And what do you do? And meanwhile, and there's no provision to dissolve this or any other kind of charter commission. And I'm not involved in the Eagan fight. I don't have a dog in that particular fight, but it's an example of what can happen when there's absolutely no accountability, absolutely no safety valve, absolutely no way to get rid of some creature. We're all accountable to ballot box, and others are at least indirectly so. But it seems to me some vehicle, no matter how generous, to make sure that they could, at least under some circumstance, be dissolved in a way other than self-dissolution. That seems reasonable to me.
All right. Further questions from members? All right. All those in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
All right. The amendment is adopted. All right. Is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, I would renew my motion that House File 1762, as amended, be recommended to pass and sent to the General Register. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Members, that's all we have. It pays to have another committee going on at the same time. I guess we only have half the members. I do have minutes, I guess. Has anyone read the minutes and would like to make a motion? All right, Representative Beard, can we do all three at once?
No.
Do we have to do them separately?
Yes.
Okay, I guess we have to do them separately.
Well.
All right, so Representative Beard moves the March 19th.
Yes, that's what I was going to bring up, March 19th.
All right, all those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Dominguez moves the September 19th minutes. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails. Yes, Representative Beard.
Do we have to be present to
no.
Make a motion?
No.
No, we don't. Okay,
we
never
don't.
Mind me then.
All right. And I'm looking for someone to move the January 8th minute. Representative Scalzi moves the January 17th minute. All those in favor, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Thank you, members. We are adjourned.